Hello everyone, welcome to Gaming on Linux podcast episode number 2. Today's date is the 26th of March 2016. I am Kieran, or Mad Machinations, and with me we have some wonderful gentlemen here to share their valuable insights about gaming on Linux.
Hey, my name's Cheese. I'm a Linux user for a long time, a gamer, developer, artist, programmer, everything under the sun. And I've been slightly involved with this game. I backed it on Kickstarter, helped out a little bit on the side, just, you know, when Linux users were having trouble, helping the developers resolve some issues. And then they hired me at some point. So I've kind of have that relationship and perspective to draw upon today.
Fantastic. Mr. Collar, would you care to introduce yourself?
Yes. Yes, it is me, Colestophilus, as usual. Linux user, whatnot, musician, whatnot. I'm a newbie.
Well, today we have been playing the Hands of Fate, which is a brilliant independently developed game. Hand of Fate? Is it Hand of Fate? Oh, I apologize. Hand of Fate.
Yeah, Hand of Fate. So good.
You have two hands. Never mind. Hand of Fate, which is a brilliantly independently developed game available on Linux. We have some nice opinions to share with you today about it. Would you care to kickstart us, Jeez, with your insights, sir?
All right. Well, I think the nice way to open this conversation is going to be like, what was the first thought you had when gameplay started?
The first thought I think I had, I thought the way that the game actually introduced itself, where you normally get a screen that says, you know, press here to start game. I thought the way the game introduced itself was absolutely brilliant. The way you just begin staring down your, is he a dealer, or your dungeon master, whatever you would know him as, I don't know, with his cards floating about, and the way it launches you straight into the immediate, I guess you could call it a tutorial. It doesn't quite feel like a tutorial, but it flows really, really nicely.
Yeah, indeed, the opening scene. It was nice, and also what I really loved about it is the guy actually starts talking to you in a very awesome voice, and plus, in addition to that, there's so nice ambient music in the background. The audio that is used throughout the game, it's one of its really high points, at least to me. As if you're running it with a good set of headphones, then it really makes the mood for the whole adventure which you're gonna play through. So that was awesome.
Yeah, on the music note, I quickly point out for anybody who's not familiar with Jeff's work, Jeff Van Dyck was also the composer for Alien Isolation, or he worked on Alien Isolation. He was a composer for Assault and Rig Cactus, and the other Linux game that he was in, or other game that is now on Linux that he did music for, was Medieval 2 Total War.
That explains a lot.
Yeah, Jeff is really talented. He's a really nice guy. I've had the chance to meet him a couple of times. But yeah, the soundtrack on this is fantastic. My first impressions of the game, and I guess I backed it on Kickstarter, so that's kind of... My first impressions of the game were playing an early release version, one of the earliest Linux builds, and kind of just seeing... I got this kind of sense that there was a lot of potential and scope that could be encompassed by the game, which it grew to expand and fill out very well. But yeah, like, it did feel a little bit more bare bones than it is now, but it just really had this great sense of possibility about it, and I'm like really happy and impressed with the way that it came together.
Coming back once more about the actual audio, what really amazed me was the continuity of it, in a sense that you have this nice ambient background when you're like talking to a dealer and just moving yourself about, but when you cross over to that battle area, or let's say you visit a shop or a tavern or whatnot, the crossover from the adventure music to the actual battle music, it's so seamless and smooth. It really, really doesn't try to take you away from the game for one moment. It just soothes you over. Let's go there. It's awesome.
That's a brilliant point, actually. Come to think of it, I don't think I ever noticed a single transition in the soundtrack. It was very well put together. The game itself felt it's very non-invasive. You know, it didn't get in your face. For me, you know, let you just sort of enjoy it at whatever pace you want to enjoy it at. If you want to enjoy it really quickly, you can do so. If you want to enjoy it really slowly while you have a beer, then you can also do so. It's a really nice execution.
It's amazingly atmospheric as well. And I think that that attention to detail regarding the seamless transitions between the third-person gameplay and the tabletop gameplay, I think that that kind of attention to detail carries across to a lot of other areas as well, like not just audio, but kind of visually and tonally as well. It does a really good job of meshing the two.
I absolutely loved when it changed to the, I don't know what you would call it, I suppose, the adventure mode, the typical sort of, you know, action-adventure sort of game mode. The way it stacks the cards on top of your character for what you have to play with.
You like get the items coming down.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Great. I absolutely loved that. It was such a nice little feature, you know. I mean, it's something so small, but it really, really adds so much to the game when you're playing it.
Yeah, and that's one of those, again, a transition thing, is like you get the monster card comes up and you see it in front of your face, and then the background changes, the card stays where it is. And once the background is in place and the 3D environment is there, then the card zooms off into the distance and your enemies climb up out of it. It's great.
It is.
It is awesome. And when you come to think of it, the game itself, it doesn't offer you that much variation. You basically have those two stages where you're like adventuring or you're battling something. So there is not... It's not that big, but what has been done, all the attention to detail, it's really magnificent in this title.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, because this is the first like really big title that the studio has worked on. And even though many of them have industry experience elsewhere, it's still really kind of neat to see, again, the attention to detail, production values that this fairly small team has been able to pull together.
It does definitely feel like a much larger production than it obviously actually was in terms of the resources that were available to do it. It does feel much more like a game that you could buy off the shelf for any console, and you would think that a large company has put it together.
When I interviewed Morgan, the creative lead on this game, I asked him how he felt about Linux users and what kind of experiences they'd had. And he used the term hitting above their weight, which I thought was interesting. And I would say that the game as a whole, in general, feels to me like the work that Defiant has done is certainly hitting above their weight. So we kind of skipped over this, but for anybody who hasn't played the game, how would each of you describe it or sum it up?
It's like a cross between Dungeons and Dragons and Jumanji, but in card form and on your computer... with some World of Warcraft thrown in there while you're at it. It's a fascinating mix that works so well. You know, to the point where I'm surprised no one's actually done that kind of, you know, collection of features before, really. I mean,
originally I thought, yeah, it's something along the lines of Dungeons & Dragons when you move about, but the battle system is... like a low-level Batman Arkham Asylum mix of some sorts with all the dodge, but this is an industry standard already. No one's gonna do anything differently basically nowadays, until someone innovates humongously. But it's a strange game, really really lovely to play in both short bursts and long sessions. But I really don't know how else to describe it.
I normally call it a turn-based dungeon crawler with real-time third-person combat. But you kind of got to add that on top, it's got this tarot card-type aesthetic to it. And I kind of really feel, to me, when I play to me, when I've played the game, it doesn't really come across as being a card game as such. It feels more like a typical dungeon crawler with... all this card graphics. Even the deck building feels more like it's tuning the RNG of a dungeon generator rather than like deck building as such.
Yeah, you can customize the sort of experience you're going to get from the game by choosing what encounters might come up possibly in your stack, you know, for the next round, and what equipment might be available to you to draw from. That was certainly interesting. Although it's one thing I didn't seem to get, or I still haven't grasped it quite in my head from what I've seen of the game and played of it so far, is that when you start a new round, you seem to start from well, the beginning, again, in many respects, apart from the cards that you have in your stack to draw against from. You know, all your gold sort of disappears for the most part, and your food disappears. And you kind of have to hope that you know, you get those things back again during that current round if you want to be able to utilize them, which I thought was a little bit odd. I mean, I suppose from a programming perspective, it seemed to make sense. It was a much easier, nicer execution for it. But I was expecting, once I'd started to play the game a bit, that, you know, you would sort of build those things up a little bit more and advance your character a little bit for the subsequent rounds that come along thereafter. But maybe that's just me. I don't know.
So when you defeat a row of cards or a row of bosses, the game unlocks for you, you know, the idea is that you're playing the dealer for a particular artifact. When you defeat that row of bosses, you get that artifact and you get some character bonuses or some stat upgrades to go along with that. So that might be increased starting health or a piece of improved starting equipment. But at the same time, the enemies get upgraded. You may have noticed these dots down the side of the card. And as they fill up, that indicates their strength. So skeletons might get some damage and health increases, or Ratmen might, or whatever is appropriate for the upgrade that you've received. But in that way, the game kind of increases its difficulty, but also increases your power at the same time over a long series of plays. But individually, if you're just doing one run, then no, there's no difference between it. And I think this is like, you know, you're coming back to saying like the cards could be anything. This game is really heavily inspired by FTL. And if you kind of view it from that perspective, it's got the same kind of, you run through the game from the beginning, it's always the same kind of starting thing that you get. The progression is that you unlock new ships, which give you new ways of approaching the game, I suppose.
I see. That makes a bit of sense, I suppose. I guess I went into it with maybe the wrong perspective. I don't know. Carlo, what are your thoughts on that particular mechanic?
I actually really like it because, as you guys already mentioned, you go along, you deal the hands, you go on the adventures, and you gather the artifacts, you upgrade your main deck, which you then build against the next encounters. But the adventures, the rounds themselves, they're not actually that long. So most of the time, or the longest adventure that I've had is probably like 15 to 20 minutes. And actually, a cool part about it is that at any point, you can just quit. You can just go out the game, and when you get back, the dealer will just greet you, and okay, let's just continue our game. It's so awesome!
Along those lines, the dealer, I thought, was fantastic, the way that they did the dealer. I mean, occasionally says something that's obviously, you know, a bit crap, but... for the most part, the stuff he comes out with is pretty amusing. It actually reminds me of, did any of you guys ever play, it was a board game years ago, and it came with like a VHS tape. It was called Atmosphere, I think, where they had like the game master that was going on inside this VHS tape that would sort of dictate the game to you. And I don't know, some of the stuff that the dealer comes out with in Hand of Fate reminds me a lot of the guy that ran Atmosphere. You know, it's this constant companion that keeps you amused above and beyond the gameplay itself.
He's kind of got this kind of dungeon master air to him as well.
Yeah, the most obvious like comparison would be if you in real life were playing a match of Dungeons and Dragons in real life, real friends. He's like the dungeon master. All those snarky comments like, the nature is against you, so am I. so weird stuff like that. But it cracks you up, and it's awesome.
That's pretty cool. So he's the character has been awarded a bunch of, or been featured in a bunch of you know, like top 10 non-player characters from games. It's like a whole bunch of lists that's been featured in. People really latch onto the dealer, which is interesting because the dealer himself, he's presented as having a lot of character but no narrative. Like he doesn't have any kind of arc, any kind of. Without delving into the ending of the game, he doesn't have anything to do beyond just laying out the cards and offering a few comments here and there. But all of the comments are kind of framed around your actions and what you do rather than what the dealer himself may be feeling. That as a character, he doesn't have a lot of like direct, meaningful presence of himself, he's all about reflecting the player's actions and the player's perspectives, or the perspectives they want the player to have.
It is interesting that the players would latch onto him so much. At the same time, I can see why. I mean, I suppose he is very much the humanized aspect of the game, really. I mean, he introduces himself to you as, you know, this being his game, and you've dared to come and play it against him. And, you know, I mean, that's the very first thing that you hear when you start the thing. And, you know, I guess there's no escaping that for any of the players, you know, as they continue to play the game. They're purposefully playing this dude in this game of life, as he puts it, you know, to win.
So do you guys kind of have impressions of what the story is, like who the player is? Do you feel like you've gained that from playing?
No. Not from the amount I've played thus far. I've got to the point where, you know, the levels, if you want to call them that, are more diverse. You actually have, you know, some choice as to which direction you want to go in now, as opposed to the very linear track that the game offers you in the early rounds, where, you know, you've pretty much got no choice but to go into the one next card that will take you to the next card, that will take you to the end card for that level and to complete those encounters. So I have no real idea for the story or what have you. We're still just sort of playing this game of life, like against this dude in some dungeon somewhere.
I think it's pretty much the same here. I got no idea who the actual guy is. Not the dealer, but the guy who you're playing as.
Okay. Yeah, I certainly don't want to reveal how it all ends. But as you play, the dealer does kind of reveal a few bits and pieces, which randomly may or may not come up as you play. And the sort of core premise seems to be that cards are made up from the events of the protagonist's life, and you're kind of playing through your memories. And there are a couple of cards where it feels like the developers were considering like actually pushing into the player's background and exploring a little bit of that, but it doesn't really dive in there. But it's an interesting thought.
If you take it too literally, then think about the guy. He has slain dozens of goblins, dozens of skeletons in his life, and lived through hundreds of ambushes.
He's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's like tough as nails adventurer, right?
And that damn ravine. How many times has he been in that damn ravine?
And I just googled Hand of Fate, and what do you guys think? What was the first suggestion that Google had? Well, who is the Hand of Fate's voice actor for the dealer?
It's Gordon.
So is there obviously... there are like three other titles for that have Hand of Fate in their name, if I remember right?
Wait, 2015 RPG card game. No, that one should
this
be
one.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah, additional. Yeah, the dealer and some additional voices. Now I'm interested. Now I'm gonna check out where he has been acting before as well, because his voice is awesome. He's a really good selection for the title.
He does do well at it. He has some very nice delivery of a lot of his lines. I mean, some of them are hit and miss, but I think that's really more about context, about when the game chooses to deliver them, rather than, you know, how they actually sound.
And the voice work in the game, like, there's not much at all, really. You know, the enemies make a few grunts when you hit them, and that's about it. So combat, we kind of already mentioned Batman as an inspiration there. I haven't played it, so I can't kind of talk to that at all, but I do gotta say that when playing through the combat, there's this wonderful sense of rhythm that you can get if you're kind of doing it right. The idea is that you don't want to like spam your buttons. You want to like press them just as they're needed, because that gives you more time to respond and more time to decide what you're gonna do. But there's this lovely sense of rhythm. As your combo increases, the distance that you'll automatically jump to reach an enemy expands a little bit. So you kind of have the ability to like just like leap through the battlefield and be really agile at the same time, and yeah, I just really love that.
You do. I did actually quite like the combat. At first glance, I thought it was maybe slightly simplistic, but when you really get going and the enemies really start piling up, and you know you're doing counterattacks and you're blocking attacks, the way that they animated that was very impressive, I thought. It is a very fluid motion between blocking and countering, and you know the game responds in such a way. It looks exciting. You know, it looks fantastic. It doesn't have that sick judder that so many games have, where you go between blocking and attacking, and it, you know, the character just sort of freaks out for a moment while it changes action mode. You know, and you're off doing something else. It's so fluid.
That happens a lot. Like, games typically sacrifice responsiveness over, you know, kind of nice-looking behavior, whereas this game doesn't really. Like, it is a pleasure to watch as well as play.
Along the lines of watching, one thing that did, I don't know, so much irritate me. It didn't really irritate me, but it did make me feel sort of like, You know the points in the game where it says, okay, pick out these four cards, and, you know, some of them will be success, or huge failure, or failure, and it's basically the equivalent of rolling a dice. And I know that there is an order to the way that they're shuffled. I have seen it, and I've, you know, managed to pick the right card a couple of times, but it happens so quickly that it is almost impossible to track which card it is that you're going for. I assume that they tried a more conventional shuffle where the cards, you know, went around maybe in circles and you could sort of track where everyone was. And I'd assume that kind of system would probably be too easy for the players to be able to say, well, that's a huge success, you know, I followed that one. But the one that they've gone for, I think, was maybe just a little bit too hard.
Well, it is RNG after all in the end, but there are actually some tricks to it. For example, for some occasions, they only get shuffled once. If they get shuffled two times or more, then it's a trouble. But if they get shuffled once, you always look at the card which goes to the top, and then you kind of have to remember, was it a bad sign or a good sign? So you can get away for like half of the occasion.
Where you can also track the cards going behind, because they like kind of accelerate at different rates depending upon where they're going to end up. So you can watch and recognize their easing animation to work out where they're meant to be. And the whole idea behind it is sort of meant to be that it is trackable, and you're meant to feel like it's trackable, and that's like a skill that you have to build. But at the same time, because everything does pass behind it itself, there's a little bit of uncertainty there as well. So it's kind of like the idea is that you're meant to feel empowered when you get it right, and you're meant to feel like you're the one that made a mistake when you get it wrong. Like that, I think that was the intention.
It does come off that way to some extent. It's obviously, it's an incredibly difficult thing to balance. I can appreciate how difficult it would be to balance something like that on a computer screen. It's just, it's not going to happen very easily, is it, really? But I mean, I think
frame rate has an impact as well.
Frame rate? I suppose frame rate could have an impact. It didn't. The game ran flawlessly for me. I can't say, oh, it was the frame rate or it was lag or anything like that. It was me sucking, you know, like there's no escape from that. it would be nice if there were just a little bit more possibility. As Collis said, when it shuffles it once, it's easy to track. When it shuffles it twice, you are hosed. You know, there's no point. You just pick anyone at random and be done with it.
What I noticed today, actually playing it, that the developers have still been actively patching the game and increasing the amount of content that it actually has. So that was a great surprise for me, at least. I saw, like, okay, let's continue where we left off. I haven't played the game for about a month, so let's see what's going on. And there's all these new cards, and, there you have it. There's, like, this one card which gives you the ability, when they shuffle everything up, you choose the wrong card, you can reselect or reshuffle everything. So you get, like, a lifesaver that way. It's awesome.
There's also a helmet you can get. I think it's a clairvoyant helm where you can mark one card to follow. You don't know what it is, but it reduces the number of cards that you have to keep track of, if that makes sense. The additional content, just something that I wanted to bring up as well, it's been divided into two types. So there's paid DLC that you can get, and there's been a bunch of free updates. The most recent free update was this very large kind of thing that was released in stages over a series of weeks. It was called Winter's Hunt, I think it was, and consisted of three separate sort of narratives or storylines, I guess. So it's kind of three separate root cards that you get that will unlock these kind of splitting narratives that explore what each of the portions of the update are. The first update that it got for free was this something that actually kind of brought a slight mechanical change to the game, which is the fate system, where in addition to building out your encounter deck and your weapons deck, you can now choose a fate card, which inserts a couple of cards into your deck here and there, but also changes the way that you play. So there's one where you can't pick up any money or something, or there's one where enemies are always harder, or there's one where you don't consume as much food when you move. And like all these kind of modifiers is a nice way to think about what they are. When that first Fates thing was added, there were, I think, two or maybe three that were added to the base game, but then there was a paid DLC called Wild Cards, which brought in a whole stack of Fates, which gave different variations for how to play the game. Have any of you guys touched or messed around with the Fate stuff at all?
I have not, no. I haven't checked out the DLC. I actually keep meaning to do that and see what's available. I think I only saw two DLC downloads that are available. I mean, I'm probably remembering that wrong. I think there was a soundtrack and there was...
One's a soundtrack and the other one is Wild Cards, which has the extra fates.
I'll have to check that out. That sounds like it could be interesting.
No, unfortunately, I haven't had the time yet to check out all the stuff, but yeah, downloadable content. I can see Wild Cards and the OST currently. These are the paid downloads at least.
Yeah, and obviously the free DLC or content updates have just been merged with the base game, so you don't have to install them separately. And the way that you kind of turn those on and off is just by removing their cards from your deck, not putting them in if you don't want to play that stuff.
I actually found it quite interesting the way that they incorporated food into the movement of your character throughout each level. I actually really liked the way that they did it. You know, for anyone that hasn't played it, every time that you move to a different encounter on a particular level, you lose at least one food. And when you run out of food, then you start losing health to the point where you die. I haven't actually died in the game yet, so I don't know what happens when you die. But I'm kind of worried to find out, to be honest. I feel like the world might end if my character dies in the game. What actually happens when you die?
You'll die eventually.
Spoiler alert.
So when you...
you will just respawn.
When you move, and when it consumes food, it also gives you health back as well. So you can, if you choose to, you can burn through food by moving back to a card that you've already visited and then moving on. And that will increase your health. So there's this kind of interesting strategy at play there with deciding how you move around the level and whether or not you want to waste the food exploring and uncovering some card that you've missed, or whether you want to move on to the next floor and hope that you get a shop so that you can buy more food or whatever. Like this really cool trade-offs of risk versus reward that the player has opportunity to make decisions with.
I never actually considered going back and forth and using food to gain health.
There are times where you kind of need to do it to survive. But the trade-off is that you run out of food. And if you run out of food, you're going to start losing health. So it's kind of, it doesn't feel like it's unbalanced, but it kind of does give you the sense of having a little bit more flexibility and a little bit more freedom with how you approach the game.
That's probably one of the only freedoms that you get actually moving through the level, really. I mean, because of the way it draws the cards and the encounters, you know, you can't guarantee that you're going to encounter a shop. You cannot guarantee that you're going to encounter any of the characters that you know will give you a particular piece of equipment or some food or some gold or health or whatever it is that they do. You know, it's...
Some of the cards give you yes and no choices as well that you can make decisions with. So you can choose to, I don't know, I think Mr. Lionel is like one of the earliest cards that you unlock, and you can he like says he wants to do you a favor, and you can be like, well, you can give me money, or you can give me equipment, or you can give me whatever. He doesn't necessarily do that, but you have the opportunity to choose what it is that's going on.
I never actually noticed that the moving back or moving between the tiles actually gave you health. I used to always go and find, like, okay, there was this traveling merchant, I need to go back there, and then I just go back there, and then were these goblins or whatnot, and they're grabbing all my food, and then I need to kick them around. And eventually I would run out of food, and then like, come on, this final guy is right around the corner, I know it.
I love it when you run out of food and you limp to the final encounter and you just scrape through with like one health left or something. It's amazing.
Oh yes.
Yes, it's very interesting when the rounds get like that. They seem to get more like that as the rounds progress to be more and more difficult. That's something I'm actually looking forward to about going further into the game. It's one of the. I must say, when I play games, I rarely finish them. I play them to the point of boredom, and Hand of Fate, I can actually see myself going back to and playing more and more and more of it. It does want to keep you coming back. It is a nice experience to go through it, the way it breaks it up.
I think that the reason behind this, you can play it in short bursts because it's just this one round, and then you get the feeling after completing it, okay, maybe just this one round more, I can surely beat that. And then you get bored of it, and eventually you just have like 10 to 15 minutes to spare. You're like, oh, there's this Hand of Fate. I was there. Right? Let's just try this one more round. It makes you keep coming back for more.
it's very easy to like just continue playing. I find it hard to stop. Like, as you finish a run, and like you say, the runs are short, and that feels like it would be a good stopping point, but you've also probably unlocked a couple of cards, and you're like, well, I should probably go into the deck builder and just look at those and see what they do. And then once you're in there, you're like, well, that sounds really cool. I might just, you know, have a short game and see what those new cards are. And then, of course, you unlock new cards from those.
Ah, sneaky little developers.
So, like, as far as I've gathered, the end of the game is when you've filled the cabinet, or when you've unlocked all the cards in the cabinet. Is that right? Is that the way it's supposed to be? Because I know there's a story mode and there's an endless mode, isn't there? And I'm purely about story mode here.
Yeah. So, story mode, I guess it depends upon how you want to view the story. And this is probably the most interesting aspect for me. So, you've got the kind of story of you sitting in front of the dealer playing a game. And that is, you know, the card cabinet represents that. That's all the bosses that you've got to go through and defeat. But then there are also all of these individual narrative threads that are revealed as you play through the cards and stuff. And those can continue, you know, depending upon how much you focus on unlocking cards and getting tokens and stuff, that can continue way beyond when you defeat all of the bosses in the cabinet. So I would say that for the story of you as the player playing the dealer, the cabinet represents the limit of that story. But there's a lot of these individual little stories that the card chains represent. They're kind of endless because the developers keep adding more content. So it's a lot of that stuff.
That's a fair point, actually. I did notice that some of the cards, when you revisit the same cards or the same encounters, I should call them encounters. When you revisit the same encounters again when they come up in the next round, some of the options have changed, and when you go on options that you went on beforehand, the outcome will certainly be different as well, which is something else interesting. There was a goblin character that I kept in the deck because he kept giving you a shield, and the shield is very useful. And as far as I've got, I don't know this for a fact, but as far as I've gathered, if you don't have a shield, then you will struggle to block attacks when you enter the adventure mode, which is, at that point, I think you can only dodge an attack, can't you? That seems to be the way of it. So a shield is valuable. I've come to know it as you know, the holy grail that you need every round, like, to try and make things easier for yourself. But he doesn't give it to you beyond a certain point. You know, he'll just sort of steal the bread off your plate and run off with it, having given you some gold or something else that you didn't really want. You know, you wanted your shield, but that's what you got, so deal with it. And then the dealer says, oh, I'm sure you're grateful for that. I'm not. Like, where's my shield? Oh, well, next card.
Makes you think that you're going to get your free shield, but then pulls the rug out from under you. But no, there are also cards. I'm trying to think of like an early thing that's like that. Anything that has a token, like it has like a symbol at the bottom of the card, and the idea is that if you complete the card, that encounter in a certain way, then it unlocks another card, and that card is related somehow to the first one. So there's really good example is there's one where you find this altar in the desert, and there are a bunch of monsters there, and you fight them, and that's the encounter. And you go, oh yeah, okay, it's a thing. You unlock the next card, and the next card says the cultists come out, and they've spotted that you've done, you know, you've defeated these things, and they offer you a deal, and they say, all right, you fight these things for us, and we'll have more work for you. So you fight the things for them, and they say, thank you, all right, well, we want to meet you here at a certain day, you know, in the future, and that unlocks another card, which is you coming back to help them fend off their enemies while they do their ritual thing. And so there's like five cards or so in a row that kind of like
progress this narrative of this ritual happening and at this altar and these cultists do and stuff. And at the end, it has this kind of conclusion that brings closure to that little story. So it's like, that's one example of how the game kind of has these sorts of narrative threads that I was talking about. You're not guaranteed to get any individual card in every play, so you may or may not, you know, the time over which you're revealing this narrative is usually quite broad and quite disparate. It's all really spread out.
Never really actually encountered anything like that in the game yet, but it only leads me to think that there's a whole lot of games still left there out there which I need to experience.
I think that's the point of Endless Mode, really, isn't it? To try and experience all that there is to experience that it has to offer you. I do very much like the way they've broken up a lot of the sub-stories that are going on in the game, where it is broken off into encounters. I haven't encountered any of these chained encounters that you're talking about, Cheese, but it certainly sounds like a good way to do it. I do like that you can sort of, especially if you manually manage your deck. I mean, I know it will do it automatically for you if you want it to, but if you manually manage your deck, you can choose what encounters you're sort of interested in and what ones that you don't really care about, and you know, it does eliminate the chance of something you don't really care for coming up in the story, or, you know, coming back to it and bringing that card into play later down the line and sort of exploring it after you've done some of the other ones. It's an interesting way to keep it fresh, really, from round to round to round.
Okay, I just wanted to ask it. Geez, you know, you obviously have the most experience with the game. What is it with the unlocking of the cards? Do you unlock every card there is throughout the story mode in the end, or you will have a whole bunch of things to unlock still in the endless mode later on? Because I personally haven't tried the endless mode yet, obviously.
Yeah, Endless Mode is pretty much just the same as Story Mode, except there's no boss at the end, you just keep going.
Okay, so there's no unlocking any further cards or anything like that, you already had the full decks there.
You still unlock tokens for completing individual card encounters the way that you normally do, but there's no, like, extra bosses or anything to unlock, if that makes sense.
Okay.
I'm actually hunting for, I have here somewhere, a big map of, like, the card chains and how the encounters work, and it's from when the game was first released, so it's only a small portion of the content that's in there now, but it does kind of illustrate the way that the things are related. So if you look at, say, under the jacket, here is a card called the Crucible that you can unlock, which is meant to be this place that you go in and they force you to do a bunch of fights. It's like this kind of weird town where they're kind of very brutal, and they capture you, and they put you in an arena, and you've got to fight a bunch of things. But from that, you unlock a bunch of other cards, and one of them is the Noble Trader, and there's this guy that you come across, and you have the opportunity to do a little deal with him, and you can, so you do that, it's great, that unlocks one called, he tells you, like, this rumor about something else, and you unlock the next card, which is the Lovers, and you have the opportunity to help these two characters who are being kicked apart by their parents. You have the opportunity to help them escape together if you want, or you can do something else to get a different reward. But if you unlock that, then that unlocks another card, which unlocks another card, and further down is the Lonely Bard, which is one of the two characters from the Lovers, and it turns out that she's left him, and he's on his own. He's very sad about it, and so that's kind of like the consequences of your actions are kind of reflected in the future cards.
There's quite a lot of possibility on the list. It's way more so than I thought. In fact, actually, looking at that, I think when I entered into the game, I was looking to try and decipher the rules of a card game, which is obviously not going to happen in a game like this. You know, it's not about the cards so much as, you know, the way they interact with one another. It's about the cards that you're dealt at any given point. You aren't going to decipher the rules of this odd card game that's happening at you.
Another example is under the Jack of Plague, which is the first kind of Ratman boss that you get to deal with. There are three cards called Ratman Hunting Party, and they have a lock. You can't remove those from your deck. They're kind of stuck in there, and that's just a combat where you fight several rat cards and just a normal combat encounter, and you think nothing more of it. But there's another card called Culling the Ratman, and there's this king, and he's meant to be fed up with all these ratmen running around the kingdom, and he charges you with the task of killing a bunch of ratmen and wiping them out. And if you do that, then the locks on the Ratman Hunting Party cards are released and you can finally remove those from your deck. So you're kind of stuck with that until you progress through the related sort of quest chain, I guess.
The developers seem to have a good humor as well. Assassin's Greed.
Yeah. That's the name of a ring, I think.
It's like a glove. Assassin's Greed.
A glove, yeah.
Queen of Plague.
Nice.
It is a fairly impressive tree. I appreciate it. Probably doesn't incorporate all the possibilities that are there today. Probably not even near at this point, but it does certainly seem to have... It gives you some idea for the layout of the way the cards are going to be thrown at you, I suppose, in many respects, that sort of reinforces that it isn't a card game that you should try and decipher rules for. You should just let it happen at you and hope for the best.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's a difficult game to describe in general, I think. So there is that kind of hurdle, a challenge associated with conveying exactly what it's about. I don't know whether that's a blessing or a curse. Like, it's kind of nice.
It is a very difficult game to describe. After I played it for a little bit, I was actually wondering, obviously we're just going to be talking about it today. I thought, oh, Jesus, what the heck? What is this? What am I playing? How am I going to talk about it? I don't even know what it is myself. How am I going to talk about it with other people?
I guess the best way to describe it is just tell the person, like, come on, you got the dough. Just go buy it, play it yourself.
Absolutely, you should definitely be bought. If you don't have it and you haven't played it, you should definitely buy it. I think it is worth every single penny of the £20 that they ask for. It has so much replay value, which is something that I personally look for in a game. Anyway, you can come back to it time and time and time again, and there will be new stuff for you to do, and there will be new stuff to play, and it will keep you interested.
Yeah, like I said, I'm nearly 100 hours in, and there's plenty of stuff that I haven't found yet. So, yeah.
Was there anything that you guys didn't like about the game, or would prefer it was done differently?
Dum dum dum. We're finally at that point.
I really want to see something like that map that we were looking at. I'd like to see that in the game where when I'm building my deck, I've got the card there and I can press a button and I can see the history, like I can see the chain. Because, like you say, you play games pretty quickly. It's if you choose to zip through it nice and fast, you might not remember what each individual card has done or what the story encounter was all about or the story of the encounter was all about. But yeah, I would like the ability to review that, because now I'm late in the game. I've unlocked probably the majority of cards. All of the previous cards in the chain don't exist anymore. You can't put those in your deck. So you just kind of left with the final outcomes of everything and no context for those if you want to remember what it is that you've done previously. So I would really love to see that. I feel like that's kind of like a little bit of a weak spot.
There are so many things I would like to touch upon.
Go right ahead, sir.
Do it, yeah.
First of all, obviously the mouse issues with the let's say the shopping interface, right? You said that when you purchase an Apple, it doesn't update the cost of it, like. But the core of it is that when you select an item in the shop with the mouse, you need to press backspace to get out of the item or scroll through the items with the arrow keys on the keyboard. That's something
you can use the mouse wheel as well.
I don't have a mouse wheel. Don't ask.
You don't have a mouse wheel.
I don't have a functioning mouse wheel. Okay.
It's kind of broken. Well, fair enough then. But no, if you can actually just left click on them as well in the shop. You can click on a card that's further around, and it will bring it to the center.
Doesn't it actually buy it immediately?
No. You have to double click if you want to buy. So it's got to like have focus, and then you click again to buy.
That's really odd. I actually didn't encounter any of these issues. I played it with a Steam controller and, in general gamepad mode, and it was beautiful. I didn't actually touch it with a keyboard and mouse. I haven't encountered any of this myself.
Yeah, actually.
It does feel like the game has been designed for gamepads first, and keyboard and mouse support is something that's kind of a little bit of a tacked on, maybe.
That absolutely, I can praise the game for. I tried it with a keyboard and mouse, but when I switched over to Steam controller, it's so nice. It immediately changed the prompts. Everything just worked flawlessly. It just works out of the box, even with the default settings that the Steam overlay recommends for you. You don't need to mess around with those.
Yeah.
And obviously, alt-tabbing, it works. It works like a charm. There's so many games that just either crash or, you know, get artifacts when you re-maximize the window. But this one just functions. And I believe it's a Unity title, correct?
It is, yeah.
Another thing that actually, what I would say that it's kind of horrible, but I think that's due to the Unity engine. The FPS is rock solid. I have a nice gaming rig, which I expect everything to run maxed out, and I accept nothing less. So the game runs perfectly, unless there's a forest scene. With a forest scene, the FPS just drops to like 30, 40. Which is not acceptable for me, but I can live through it. It's not like it's surgical precision that's needed in the game. So I guess it's not all that bad. How are your guys' experiences with the game? What kind of rigs are you actually on playing this game?
Mine is actually really basic. The one that I was using to play it on is a Core 2 Duo with only 4 GB of RAM and an NVIDIA 750 Ti. And, you know, I mean, the thing was flawless. I mean, maybe there was some frame rate drop that I, you know, or at least my human eyes didn't notice. I would suggest, Carla, that if you don't like the frame rate dropping, you turn off the frame rate counter.
No!
And then you have no problems. Oh!
No, there have always been certain scenes that give significant frame rate drops, and some of those have been addressed over time. I guess some of those not so much. But yeah, that has always been an issue, and it's been an issue on the console versions of the game as well. There are some underground cavern levels. If you walk into a particular location where the camera is at a particular angle, it's more likely to cause issues. But yeah, like, I don't know, if you've got the settings tuned to
beautiful, fantastic,
good
everything
max. if you've got them tuned to give you a good frame rate in most places normally, then you'll be able to work through it. Like you say, like if you've got it, you're running at a solid 60, it'll probably drop down to 40. But if you're running it at 25, 30 to make it look nice, and you're happy to just have that normal experience of 25 to 30, then it will probably drop down to 5 or 10.
Say no to cinematic gaming.
There is. I'd say as well that the sort of general performance behavior has changed a bit after upgrading to both the Unity 5 upgrade, which introduced physically based rendering. That was a big visual change for the game. And also upgrading to 5.3, which brought in Unity's new OpenGL renderer. Yeah, so there have always been these locations or environments within the games that have caused slowdowns for players. And like typically if you can run at a solid 60, then it might drop down to 40 or whatever, like you were saying. But if you kind of keep that sort of 25, 30 as your default frame rate, then it might drop down to 10 in those locations. So it's kind of a matter of sort of tuning the settings to make sure that you're getting the best performance anyway. But this has also been an issue on the console versions. And it's been resolved for some environments, not so much for others. But the other aspect, performance-wise as well, is that alongside sort of updating the content in the game, the developers have also been updating the engine as well. And that means bringing in physically-based rendering when Unity 5 launched and using Unity's new OpenGL renderer with Unity 5.3. And I think both of those have sort of increased the resource usage of the game. And that's a really interesting thing, to kind of have all these extra features and have all this cool new stuff in the game, but at the same time, if you were already at the bottom of the system requirements, kind of in a bit of an awkward situation where the game may not run as well as it used to. And that's kind of interesting situation that I don't think, you know, go back 10 years, that didn't really happen, but it's something that we see more and more of now. Like when Valve updated Dota 2 to Source 2, the system requirements changed and a bunch of people couldn't play anymore.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, with the Unity engine more specifically, when you're at the higher end of the spectrum, let's say I have this 970 GTX running inside my case, and with the Hand of Fate, the performance has always gone better for me with every release. And same goes for, like, let's say, War for the Overworld. Every release, they patch something up with the engine, my performance has increased. But on the same time, guys who are already on the minimum edge, then they're basically going to just suffer.
To be fair, the resources it requires are quite low, and if your system does not meet those requirements, you probably should have upgraded it about 12 months ago to, you know, even as some kind of rudimentary degree to keep it running properly. Well, it's something you're going to see more and more, really, isn't it? I mean, there is no definitive end to optimizing a game. We are in the future now, to some extent, apart from you at the moment, Cheese, who obviously can't download anything without it taking 10 years.
Well, it's been Sunday for 9.5 hours for me, so I still feel like I'm in the future, right?
Actually,
still got the card to play.
Touching the minimum requirements topic, I'm checking it at the Steam right now, the minimum requirements for Hands of Fate, and NVIDIA 260 GTS, I'd say if you have that card, then you're probably 5 years too late. You should have upgraded.
Yeah. Oh, you know, on that note, there was somebody with a 260 GTS who's saying, oh, I can't really get the game running, and I'm like, wow.
Oh man!
You know,
sorry.
I don't know if I can help you. It's listed in the minimum requirements though, so either they need updating or the developers need to kind of look at trying to do some optimizing or alternative performance profiling or something. But at the moment, the person with that card, I don't think they're going to be able to get much out of the game.
No, they need to update the minimum requirements, and the person with that card needs to be given a typewriter and a carrier pigeon, and we can all move on with our lives.
No, I think it's really awesome when you can run a game on really old hardware. I think any time that you can avoid upgrading, that's amazingly cool. So, like, props to that guy for you know, continuing on regardless.
That's true. It is good to see that. I don't want to say backwards compatibility, but that legacy support, I suppose, is the best term to use. But at the same time, there are situations, especially if you're using an off-the-shelf engine like Unity, that is constantly rolling forward and you have to keep up with it. Your hands are kind of tied as to what you can continue to support and what you can't, unless you want to do a complete and total freeze on what it is that you do and sacrifice any newer features that would otherwise be available to you and to the vast majority of the users. For the sake of legacy.
Well,
support.
I would say that Hand of Fate is definitely in the minority so far as games that regularly upgrade the engine version go. Like, it's quite typical, particularly for Unity developers, for people to kind of go, no, it's too much hassle to upgrade the engine version. If everything is working now, we don't touch it. And that's kind of how a released game is usually handled, unless there are significant bugs that you're trying to get past. But everybody I know who's upgraded to Unity 5 has had a nightmare of a time getting up and running. Like, it's been a massive amount of work to migrate between versions.
That's interesting. And you'd think that it would get easier.
You would hope. And, like, because Unity do that. They're constantly releasing patches and updates. You would hope that they put a little bit of effort into just easing those migration hurdles. But no, they don't seem to. You said.
It segues nicely, if I may, away from Hand of Fate and to one of the other things that I very much like to talk about today, which is the growing availability of platforms, engines, editors, toolkits, and other such alike for developers to be able to use on Linux itself directly. And along the lines of Unity, for all the problems that developers may have encountered with Unity 5, they do seem to have a growing amount of support for actually developing and building games on Linux. There's someone who I've been following for a little while who's obviously won't be the only person that's been working a lot on the Unity editor, Natasha Bard, she's called, who blogs quite a lot about the Unity editor on Linux, which is apparently, you know, growing in stability. I actually didn't realize just how far it had come along till the other day when I searched it out to see what had happened since I saw they released sometime last summer an editor for Linux. But I've actually found that they've kept up with all the latest versions, which actually quite surprised me. I thought that they were behind on it all, but you know, no, the latest release was actually just not too long, about a week ago, in March of this year, which is interesting that, that they've kept up with that. And UE4 as well, which I don't know. I mean, I know there's a lot of effort involved in porting an engine's editor over to a different platform, especially one like Linux, where you tend to have a lot of problems integrating things like GTK, so I've come to understand, in comparison to, you know, other operating systems like on Windows or on Mac OS, where they obviously go about things differently. And there's a lot of changing work.
You can
work
use GTK on Windows and Mac OS. It's just a matter of making those choices.
It is, but like we were saying in the last episode about, you know, choosing your libraries very wisely when you're making something, unless you've made that choice in the first place, you have coded yourself into a corner, possibly multiple corners, and then it's a case of undoing all of that while maintaining the functionality of what you had before you started trying to port it, which, you know, becomes a nightmare in itself. I've been quite impressed, actually, with the progress that Unity have made with their editor, and UE4, actually, to some extent. I don't know how many people were involved in the UE4 editor port, but I gather it was probably a community effort with its nature.
It was a community effort, yeah, I believe.
Yeah, I would imagine so, since they give you access to everything, don't they? So you can do what you will with it. But the Unity support has been very interesting to see, with so many developers using it. And so many developers using Linux as well. I mean, I saw a poll the other week that said, you know, it was a bit of a misleading poll. It said, oh, you know, like 21% or whatever it was of developers use Linux, which is more than the amount of developers that use Windows 10, I think it was comparing to. But in the thing, they had, you know, they had an entry for macOS, which was 20-odd%. They had an entry for Linux, which was 20-odd%. And they had an entry for Windows 7 and an entry for Windows 10, you know. Mm-hmm. And with Microsoft forcing all the Windows 7 users to upgrade, obviously that's going to be 40% of developers use Windows in general. But it's quite a lot of developers that use it. And I think it would be very good to see more of these tools available on Linux for them to just use. I mean, I want to build Linux games, and the notion of having to go into Windows to build a Linux game is, it's madness. You know, it's utter madness. But the one thing I would very much like to see, actually, from Unity along these lines, because UE4 don't do it because of the way that they put all of their code out there, but the way that Unity deploys things, when you go to download Unity, it says, well, which one do you want? Do you want the Mac version, or do you want the Windows version? And if you want the Linux one, you have to search out this forum post. I mean, and I gather the editor is in a beta stage at the moment, but I think it would be nice to see a link, you know, just there saying, you know, well, here's the Linux one, it is in beta, but let's put it up with the rest of them there so that everyone can know it's there, rather than having to search for it and find out for themselves it's there, or hear off someone else that it exists.
Mm.
That would certainly be nice to see.
So I get the impression that that's not going to happen until it's out of beta.
I imagine so. It's a business, isn't it? They run it as a business. That's the way it goes. Well, they all run it as a business, right? I guess, in many respects. But Unity, I think, more so has that commercial feel about it, more than UE4, more than Godot or Atomic or anything else that you choose to use. But it would still be nice to see a link there, even if it just said, you know, this is a testing build. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. That's the way of it. Here it is, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to see it highlighted, but if this means that it has the opportunity to have greater first impressions from people when it does come out of beta, then that's probably a good trade-off.
Perhaps, yeah. Originally, I would have agreed completely with you. Yeah, absolutely. But it is nearly a year since the first beta was released. And I would expect by now, even with it still in testing, that they would be a lot closer to something that they could say was mostly stable, you know, to the point where they'd be confident saying it is available for use. I mean, the UE4 editor is still technically in testing for Linux. You know, it is. They've just simply said that it is, quote, done, quote, but, you know, it needs testing, it needs bug fixing, and blah, 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 blah. But they do have that out there. So it would be nice to see the same from Unity, with so many developers using it. I mean, I gather they did showcase it at the latest, I always forget the acronym, the latest convention. What is it?
GDC.
Yes, GDC. That's the one. Well then. I gather that they were there talking about it, and it was quite good response. So, you know, I'm hoping that we'll see a more forward version of it appearing soon.
At the moment, any Linux using developers are probably aware of it. And that's, you know,
okay, it would be better if Linux users had more ability to discover it. But at the moment, I would be kind of worried if any Windows developers were going, well, I'm thinking of leaving Windows, and now that Unity's on Linux, I'm ready to make the jump. I would rather that Unity was rock solid and able to give them everything they want and not have any complaints for anybody who was considering making that jump. So that's kind of a bit of a risk to try and mitigate there. It's also possible that they might be wanting to do like a big marketing push when they're ready to push that out in the public like that.
But it's a very interesting point. I hadn't actually considered from the perspective of a current Windows developer trying to leap to Linux. But at the same time, I suppose if they're a developer, I mean, as you say, you know, most Linux developers will be aware of its existence already. Fair enough. But if you're a developer, you know what beta means. You know that it's probably going to have problems, and you'll probably have seen it in beta before making the leap.
It's tricky. Like, when it's your tools, especially when it's a tool you're familiar with, if you go, oh yeah, I know how to do this in the Windows version, it's not working in the Linux version, I can see that it's meant to be here because all the buttons are the same, obviously it's Linux fault.
Perhaps.
Like, it's tricky. It's really tricky. And I know people who get really frustrated and logic goes out the window when their tools aren't behaving.
That's true, but that's good advice. So if you have made the leap from Windows to Linux and Unity isn't behaving for you, it's not Linux's fault. It's Unity's fault.
That's right, yeah. reading between lines as well, I haven't seen any kind of official announcement of this, but I feel pretty confident that the editor, much like the actual deployment version of the engine, has come out of individual people's Fridays are for fun. So Unity have this thing where I think it's every Friday, I assume it's every Friday, the company employees are allowed to work on personal projects, whatever they want, as long as they pitch it to the company. And so there are a couple of developers there, Natasha, her partner Levi, and a few others who are, you know, Linux-focused, and they sat down and used their own kind of this Friday's a fun time to do the Linux port of the engine originally. And looking at the people who were behind it, I kind of imagine that's how it's gone on. So until it's kind of finished, until it's like 100% ready and marketable, I kind of get the impression that there's probably not a lot of company-driven priority for the project. So that could be another reason why it's not featured heavily on the website.
Yeah, I can go with that. I did note that in one of Natasha's blogs, she did say that the editor's existence was a labor of love for it coming to Linux. So you're probably dead on there. Probably was developed during these times. But it does seem to have come a long way. It would be nice to see some official support taking over from there. Since they now advertise the fact, you know, obviously that officially Unity engine itself will run obviously on Linux and on SteamOS, it is part of their listed platforms everywhere. Surely, I would assume, fingers crossed, touch wood and all that jazz, that the official editor support can't be too far behind at this point.
Yeah, I was kind of expecting it to have come out of beta by now. From what I've used, I haven't used it a lot since like the first, you know, before the public beta, but as it entered the public beta, it seemed to be pretty close to being ready. But yeah, I'm not sure what the current state is because I haven't had a chance to like mess around with it since. But I kind of hoping it'll be soon.
Oh, I hope so. That'd be interesting to see. Colin, do you have any thoughts on this?
Jesus Christ, you guys are so well informed about this.
We are nerds. We must know.
Obviously, I'm not a developer. I suck at this.
I'm kind of friends with Levi, so we talk about stuff sometimes.
And I stalk Unity and many other projects online.
I just stalk wine. Both ways, the virtual and the reality wine.
It's funny, I know some developers who use Unity and up until now had been using Unity in Wine to make their games on Linux.
Really? It's like Wineception.
Really? No, it's okay. It's not too bad. I used Unity in Wine when there was this sort of community-developed game called Bad Golf that I was sort of coordinating, and I did all the patch merging and built all the releases from Unity in Wine, and yeah, it seemed okay. So, yeah, people do it.
Wow, I never would have thought.
It definitely sounds like double debugging for me. First you try to take Windows, you use Unity, you try to build for Linux, but now you're taking Linux, you make wine bottle. for your Windows partition where you use, like...
Do you see what you've done, Unity? This is madness. Please officially support the Linux editor.
But like I said, all these people have moved across and they're using the native version and they're very happy to have the native version available now. So it's good. Positive outcomes.
We'll see some more of those positive outcomes for it as time rolls on. The other interesting thing, actually, that cropped up recently was Substance Painter 2 being announced as possibly coming to Linux at some point. And what interested me most about this, I suppose, is it will be one of the very first mainstream proprietary graphical toolkits that isn't something open source. What interests me most about it, I suppose, is that I am hoping, really hoping, that it opens the floodgates for more design software, more proprietary design software to appear on Linux, specifically Photoshop. Looking at you, Adobe, for the love of God, please.
Don't we want less proprietary software?
Well, you say that, you know, I mean, some of us do obviously want less proprietary software, but some of us still want it, you know, and I don't, personally, I don't care. I use the GIMP. But I have designers that I work with, and they, all they ever scream at me is that they want Photoshop, and, you know, it's not really a gap that can be easily filled. I mean, a lot of forums, when you go looking for support about it, you know, they will say, oh, just use the GIMP. And it's all well and good to say that, you know, but the designer doesn't want to use the GIMP. When they do try and use the GIMP, it is lacking in features that Photoshop does have that they expect to be able to use, because the outcome of their work does suffer through not having access to features and tools that they are accustomed to having and accustomed to using. Yeah. And you're basically asking them to learn their entire profession again from scratch using a more limited toolkit than what they had access to before, and they're not happy with it. I saw a very interesting thread, actually, on one of the Adobe forums about this, where I believe they ran a petition a while ago, and they actually had to shut the petition down because of how many signatures they received for doing a port of Photoshop to Linux. And that was a good 3 years ago, I think it was, when it closed. And, you know, nothing has yet to transpire at all about it whatsoever. Adobe are just sticking their fingers in their ears and la 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 la. And it's not... It really... really annoys me, even though I don't use it. I know people that do. I really want to see more software like that appearing on Linux for those users that do want to use it, because it is a real thorn in our arse for people that are wanting to make the leap or thinking about making the leap, and the fact is they just can't because the things they need to do their job aren't available. You know, and I'm kind of hoping, fingers crossed, that the appearance of, or the possible appearance, I should say, of Substance Painter 2 might sort of spur more ports along those lines to appear. That would be really nice.
Yeah, I'm happy with those people staying on Windows. That doesn't bother me.
Well, I'm not. I don't want Windows in my company.
Yeah, no, it's fair enough. I actually moved away from Photoshop. I was like, yeah, I'm not... At the time, I wasn't paying for it, and I was like, you know, if it's not worth the price they're asking, then it's not worth using for me. Like, I find piracy really hard to justify. I want to use stuff from people that I want to support, and if I don't want to support them, then why am I using their things? And that rationale kind of got me onto the GIMP, and it took me, I don't know, maybe 6 months, maybe a year to kind of regain those skills. Like, it's definitely a learning period and learning curve. And like you say, there are some things that you just can't do. But honestly, if you're using, like, Photoshop's default drop filter thing, you could go get in the sea, you know? Being dependent and reliant on all of this hacky, cliched, automatic crap is not really the best way to be a designer. The things that are missing aren't really things that are that critical for people who are doing meaningful work, I don't think.
Wow.
Take that.
Well, actually, regarding the piracy part, right. Let's just say I'm glad I've never been a designer. I've never had to actually make a living off of it, so I don't feel that bad pirating it once. then I saw that it was just too crazy for me, and I uninstalled. And I installed GIMP actually on Windows. But what I came to realize it while reading online that GIMP basically has maybe not all the features. Sure, half the features maybe. Yeah, like Photoshop. But the thing is, you gotta make so many workarounds to get to a simple thing that maybe for a Photoshop user would be just two clicks away or one simple selection. But in GIMP, you gotta set up paths and selectors, and you know, you gotta work around the issue a bit more.
You know, as like a typical Linux user, you know, I've said to them, the designer that I work with that's bitched about it, you know, well, what features specifically are you missing? Give me a list, you know, and they can't quite do it. So, you know, that leads me to conclude that it is some kind of bridge between the user and, you know, the program itself and the interface that is missing. You know, I gather that Photoshop obviously does a lot of stuff for you through a lot of the toolkits that the designers, all they care about is design. They don't care about how the design happens, you know, they don't care about how the code works, and they just want the design to be actualized on the screen the way they see it in their head through the tools.
Typical Windows Mac user. Just give it to me. I don't care how it works. I want it.
One thing that made it really difficult for me to make the transition was the fact that the GIMP uses all of the same keyboard shortcuts as Photoshop, but they do vastly different things.
They do. Yeah. They do vastly different things. And incidentally, if anyone comes across the post that says, you know, do all this, this, and this, and this to make the GIMP behave more like Photoshop, most of it is a lie, and it will just ruin your GIMP configs, so don't do it.
There's a plugin called GIMP Shop, which I think is pretty reliable and goes the effort of rebinding the keyboard shortcuts and that sort of stuff.
When was the last time you looked at that?
Years and years ago.
Right. No one look for that, because the GIMP Shop plugin has long since been dropped, deprecated, whatever you want to call it. And now,
yeah, right.
If you look for GIMP Shop, it is actually just someone trying to sell you a copy of the standard GIMP installer. So don't do that.
Wow. Yeah, I think the plugin, the biggest thing that the plugin did was give you like a single document interface, like what Photoshop has, as opposed to GIMP's default multi-document interface, which is about, like the toolbar is a window within the window rather than a window on its own that you can drag off into.
No, always use single dot window mode.
Yes, single window mode. Maybe if you're working on multiple monitors, I can see the need for having, you know, being broken up into different
windows. I do, and I cannot stand single document mode. I don't know why everybody bangs on about needing it. I'm like, it's just so cumbersome. But
precious familiarity is why.
But I think when the GIMP got that feature, I think that was the time at which the GIMP Shop plugin sort of wound down and disappeared, because that was the major feature that plugin was bringing.
It probably would have done, I imagine. I think the only remnants of it now are, you know, the kind of guides that you get saying, use this file to substitute all your keyboard shortcuts so they work like Photoshop's, but they don't work like Photoshop's, you know. Some of them are obviously the same. Press this button to get this tool, or this button to get that tool. But a lot of the users expect to be able to press a certain key command and, for example, dragging a part of the image around, you know, that you've selected and you want to transform and move away or something like that. The GIMP has a completely different way of doing that to Photoshop that a simple keyboard shortcut config file is not going to change. You know, it's getting around the fact
like
that
Control-D, I think, in Photoshop is deselect, but in GIMP it's Shift-Control-A, and Control-D, like, duplicates the window or something. And I remember at first I was, like, just constantly pressing the wrong shortcut when trying to do like a really common action like that. So like adjusting those shortcuts definitely would make migrating across easier. But I don't know, I kind of feel like if you're migrating across, you probably want to eventually stop using the other piece of software shortcuts, and you're going to have to learn it eventually. So like at what point do you make the call and go, all right, well, I'm going to learn to do it this way?
You would think so, but then the trouble at that point is, hypothetically, in this scenario, the designer has switched to Linux, they found themselves on the GIMP, they're still trying to do their job, but nothing works. So maybe the appropriate advice to give them is to stay on whatever platform you're on now, install the GIMP, learn that, and then when you're competent in it, make the leap.
Yeah, I feel like the much, much better migration path is to get rid of the platform-specific dependencies first, all the software that you can't get on other operating systems, free yourself from that operating system lock-in, and then make decisions about what you want to try and what you want to use. Because otherwise, you just, yeah, it's going to be a nightmare.
Yes, get Microsoft Link finally on Linux, which is working.
No. That means stop using Microsoft Links and use something else. And then you can move.
You can tell that to the other 50 companies that we work with.
Wow. There are 50 companies using Link. I was surprised to find one here that used Link. I was like, what the hell are you idiots doing?
Oh man, but, sometimes I wonder who are you guys working with? Because I'm in the networking business, right? So we do networking stuff for all the big companies, whatever. I cannot probably say any specific names throughout the world, right?
That's fine.
And the Link or Skype for Business, whatever, we have open communities for that, so we can connect with other companies pretty freely using that, and it integrates so well in the office, and you know, any connect, and all this just comes together in one big fucking bundle, and you really can't. When I go, every time I install Arch Linux on my work laptop and try to get things done, I get things done. That's cool. But when there's like a specific incident, like guys calling up, oh, right, I'm here. I got a console cable up this router now. I need your help. I need you to paste something simple in. You have the backups. Okay. Here am I. I'm sharing you my screen. I'm like, nope, I'm on Linux. I cannot see your screen. Sorry, you gotta install TeamViewer. I don't have time for this. Like, you know, it's these situations that really kill you.
We used to actually ship a VNC server with the client images that we rolled out to our clients when we were doing company that did similar kind of stuff, but we also built their computers and would do help desk for them and that sort of stuff. So we were doing sysadmin and help desk rolled into one.
That is reasonable if you're into that kind of management.
Yeah. But like, if they're using Windows, then there's the remote desktop protocol as well. There are definitely tools that exist that can be used more or less out of the box.
In my experience, it never works the way you want it to. I just tell them, look, if you want me to fix it, install TeamViewer, and I will help you then.
RDP's been really solid for me. It's more along the lines of getting it through firewalls and NAT and all that sort of stuff has been where the hurdles have been. Like, rather than with the tech itself, it's just routing and firewalls that get in the way.
I just use a reverse SSH tunnel for that. Like straight to their on-site Linux server, because why would you have a Windows server? If you have a Windows server, there is something seriously wrong with you.
we had to do sysadmin for a bunch of Windows servers, and I did spend a lot of time complaining about that. So dumb.
If you're complaining about Windows servers, think about that having Windows 7 as a server. You don't want to go there. You don't ever want to go there. And I have.
We had a couple of clients who had Windows 95 running as a server type role.
Like, what?
Just. Yeah, I swear. And every time I'd be all like, this is crazy, you can't run this. It's like beyond ridiculous. My boss would be all like, oh no, they don't want to pay to upgrade. Like, we just got to keep it running for them. I'm like, yeah, but it's costing them more in the long run because you got to do all this stupid maintenance.
Upgrade, and, that is a bit of a push at that point. It's so outdated that fix that is basically techromancy. Just burn the building down and be done with it.
I think upgrade was a euphemism for fully replace. We can get a Linux server up that can fulfill these roles without problem, you know? Like, they got it. Just install Mailman and they got their mailing lists, hooray. And they just didn't want to do it. It's like, well, it's working fine now, and it works fine every time you fix it. Just fix it.
Oh, God.
Yes. Try running a Cisco call manager on Windows 2000 server. Nice. We still have one customer like that, and it's... Let's say no one wants to reboot this machine.
Yeah.
No one dares to step near it.
You know, there's this thing that when I was at this other company, there's a thing that my boss really couldn't understand, is that there is such a thing as bad work, and it's important to turn down bad work and make sure that you're taking on as much good work as you can, because there are times where you say, yeah, we can do that, but if it turns out that it's not actually possible for the client's expectations to be met, if it turns out that no matter whether or not you do a good job, they're still going to feel bad about it, then that's not work you want to touch. You don't want to do that. You just go, yeah, sorry, we can't do this for you. Because otherwise, you know, like with this Windows 95 machine, it's constantly failing and it's got problems and they don't want to pay for like hard drive upgrades and other kind of, you know, essential crap. There's a point where you just got to go, no, it's going to make us look bad if we continue to maintain it and it eventually dies. It's going to be better for us and better for them if we just let them discover that it dies on its own, you know? And then they can't blame us.
Yeah, it's let's just say you don't want to have a contract on that, but a VEX contract is all good as long as they pay for every hour.
you totally got to build stuff into your contracts that cover those kinds of crazy legacy situations. It'd be like, yeah, we do this, and this, but we don't touch anything that falls in this category.
Along the lines of stuff
way out in the weeds,
just a bit. Along the lines of stuff that's appearing at the moment. Obviously, recently we've seen two engines relicense themselves: the Atomic Game Engine and the Crytek engine. Now, the CryEngine 5, anyway, that has actually piqued my interest somewhat. I did actually have a look at CryEngine a little while ago.
They're focusing on subscription-based stuff now, aren't they?
No, it's a pay-what-you-want system that they've got going on now.
Oh.
It was subscription, because it was only a little while ago I had a look at it myself, and it was still subscription, but it was relicensed recently to a sort of pay-what-you-want scheme. It still has no Linux editor, which is sad times. Mm. So unfortunately, it is still off the table for me as a possible toolkit to use, but it's very interesting that engines are relicensing themselves in this way. It seems to be en masse now. I mean, I assume it's the only way that they compete at this point because of the way that, you know, the licensing has sort of evolved.
It's funny, if you go back 5 years, you were still, Unity was the budget engine, and you were still paying multiple thousands for entry-level access to just about everything else. I mean, there was UDK was hanging around, which you could, had the limited feature set, and you had to pay Unreal if you sold more than a certain amount. I think that was how it worked. But yeah, those were the two kind of exceptions. And all the big engines, like Unreal Engine and Crytek and CryEngine and all that sort of stuff, were engines that you had to pay, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for access to and that sort of stuff. And now we've had this complete shift. Unity have gone, yeah, man, all engine features for free. And Unreal Engine have gone, yeah, we're going to give you Source, and it's only going to cost, nothing.
It does cost something.
It's a negligible amount.
It is. It's once you're making money kind of thing that they have going on, and it is a reasonable amount that they ask for, I should say.
Yeah. So you can still get access to you for free.
Yes.
Providing you accept their terms and conditions. But this is unheard of. This is crazy. There were people who were paying $50,000-$60,000 for an engine a few years back, and now we've got all this kind of professional grade industry level stuff that's available for free for people who just want to experiment and practice around and mess with stuff. It's a very, very, very different ecosystem that we're moving into now.
On the other note, actually, Shadowen, which is coming out, looks
Yeah, it's kind
really
of stealth-oriented,
awesome.
Hey.
Yeah, and it's absolutely stunning, in my opinion, at least.
It does look good. We would really like to see more stuff like Shadwin. We would really like to see more studios getting involved with Linux and bringing their titles across. There are a lot of... I found especially...
Well, the developers of Shadwin have been supporting Linux for a long, long time, long before Steam was around.
Have they now? What else have they worked on? I'm not actually aware of this.
Shadowgrounds, Trine...
Oh, really? They were doing Trine, were they?
Yeah. It's Frozenbyte, yeah.
I couldn't actually remember who'd done it. I remember the name Shadwin. I remember looking at the trailer for the demo, but that's all I've seen. It does look really, really good, though.
Shadowgrounds, which was their first game, had its first Linux port. When was that? That was in 2009. And since then, they've been bringing their titles to Linux. There was a bit of a delay for Trine
2 and trying 3. But Shadwin seems to have hit the ground running with Linux support, which is really cool.
Yeah, it runs like a charm as well. And actually, I thought about it, my favorite genre personally is just the horror games. But thankfully, the best horror game of the year, Layers of Fear, has exited its early access stage. Though I have almost completed it completely, but now it's time to revisit and get some scares on.
Along the lines of, it's not really supposed to support, I mean, because, you know, there is support there, that one of the things that's really sort of irking me lately, or has irked me, is the Day of the Tentacle remastered. You know, there's a lot of hype going around about it at the moment, and it just sort of feels like, you know,
you're Linux will get this.
Yeah, you know, the Linux users are left out, and we'll get it when everyone else is done playing with it, and we can enjoy it in our little circle, and that's basically what we get. And it is a little disappointing. I mean, that's probably a very pessimistic view to take, but, you know, that's just sort of like how I've been left feeling about it really lately. Because I have been following, you know, the release of it and seeing all the sort of events that they've got going on around it at the moment. And it's sad that we can't really take part in that sort of thing. And I guess I'm embittered by it, really, to some degree.
It is very sad that we can't participate in the launch stuff. Definitely, wholeheartedly, 100% agree with that. I can tell you that there are people at Double Fine who are also disappointed that they weren't able to make a simultaneous release. With the relationship that they have with Sony and Disney for the project, as in for funding and setting budgets and setting timelines and stuff, that the decision to not have a simultaneous launch on Linux was not necessarily due to factors that were within Double Fine's control.
Oh, of course. But at the same time, it does feel... With the Atari Vault, obviously, I mean, I know a lot of productions promise, you know, oh yeah, day one Linux support, and it never happens, which seems to be the case more often than not, sadly. But I mean, I don't know, with Atari Vault doing it lately, and Roller Coaster, I don't really care about Roller Coaster Tycoon, but they did it as well, obviously. You know, I mean, the support is still coming, but it is delayed for an unspecified period of time, just like Day of the Tentacle remastered is. And it's kind of sad that, you know, we don't get to participate on that level. And the personal worry I've got is that if it becomes the norm to push Linux to the back of the line, and, you know, we'll get around to it when we get around to it, then more studios are going to follow suit doing that.
I kind of feel like that's the default, and that's what we're moving away from. Like, we see more simultaneous releases over the past few years than we did 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, I suppose you could look at it that way. I'm a very glasses-half-empty kind of guy, so I don't see it that way.
But the thing is, if we're included in the launch hype, then that means that we're going to play, you know, that we're going to get involved with the enthusiasm, we're going to pay full price. If we're pushed out after launch, then there's going to be a lower number of people who will pay full price, there's going to be less enthusiasm, people are going to feel less engaged, they're going to be less likely to become part of the community, so delayed releases cost money. Like, that's how I view it. It's like, it's got to cost you enthusiasm and sales.
It is, but then in turn, that obviously will be reflected in the sales statistics, which will reflect upon how future developments get prioritized, because they'll look at those sales and go, oh, well, it tanked in comparison to the other platforms. And they might not necessarily take into consideration the fact that we didn't get it until 6 months later when everyone had stopped caring.
You got a multiplayer game like Evolve or something. Like, it's not so big a deal for Evolve, because it's like, what, 4 players per game? 5 players per game or something? Like, it's not hard to come up with 5 friends, but anything that's bigger, that requires, has a big multiplayer component, if the community has gone out of it, like Worms, for example, when Worms Reloaded hit, or World Party, sorry, because that actually has cross-platform multiplayer, you know, people aren't so excited by it anymore. There's not as many people playing online. It's harder to find games than it was at release. And if there had have been Linux users getting into the game at release, then that would have meant a higher number of people playing at launch and a longer tail following launch. So, like, there's that aspect as well.
Along the lines of talking about releases that are coming out soon, long-awaited releases that are coming out soon, Darkest Dungeon will be appearing. I haven't actually had a chance
I don't know anything about that.
From what I've seen, I haven't played it myself. I've only looked at trailers because I don't have a Windows partition to play it on. But it looks, in a sense, like a struggle similar to Sunless Sea, I think, but obviously more combat-oriented dungeon crawler. It gets a lot of good reviews around its art that looks really nice. Does seem to be one of the anticipated titles that's finally coming. Whether it will actually turn up next week is remains to be decided, but all they've said is to look out for something.
Is it released this year? It's like released in January or something. January 19th, 2016, I see on Wikipedia.
Is that when it released? Oh, I thought it was
apparently
much earlier than that. Or maybe it was an early access before then.
Early access period or something.
Yeah, I think it was probably an early access at that point then, because I was asked about it, I'm sure, in the autumn, you know, last year.
They had a Kickstarter campaign in 2014 and early access in February 2015. So it was in early access for about a year.
Yeah, that sounds more like it. It will have been during early access then. But it does get people love it. It's very well reviewed. Yeah, cool. So, you know, I'm actually very looking forward to playing that. And I don't really know much about it above and beyond what I've said, you know, what you can see in the trailers and the advertised material about it. Carlo, maybe you have actually played Darkest Dungeon, because do you have a Windows partition you game on? Am I remembering that correctly?
I do at the moment. I have kind of snuggled it back into the room. But the Darkest Dungeon, I must say, I checked when Total Biscuit actually made a WTF is about the Darkest Dungeon, and he was pretty thorough about the game. I must say, I love the art style. Everything that has to do with, like, dark, gothic-y, Dark Soul-esque kind of stuff, I like it, but based on the gameplay, no, it's definitely not something that I would poke with a 10-foot stick. It seems like this usual, you know, how are these games called? You get one run and then you die and it's all over. What were they? You know, I don't remember any. Binding of Isaac was one of them, anyways.
Binding of Isaac is probably an interesting one to compare it to, actually. I guess it remains to be seen, because, like I said, I don't know what the gameplay is actually like to, you know, happen at you, but I gather it does happen at you. Like, it's not something that you might particularly enjoy. Enjoy is such a strong word. You enjoy being abused, I think, is probably the air that you'll take away from it, or that's the impression that I get from the trailer. Maybe I'm completely wrong about that, but, you know, that remains to be seen.
It looks like turn-based Dark Souls. Kind of like that. With a party.
It could be. But then it's a popular format, isn't it? Or it seems to be. Especially the party-oriented games like that, party-oriented strategy games like that. There seems to be a fair amount of people that really do enjoy them. I am terrible at them, but I will try.
Coming back to that question of whether it's easy to move between Photoshop and the GIMP, I do feel like the GIMP's name works against it.
Let's say today I wanted to make a like thumbnail image and edit like some text on it, and what happened, I right click and then just like, yeah, edit in there and edit in GNU image manipulation program. What?
okay, fine. Well, it's funny, you look at Krita and MyPaint, and your MyPaint is kind of feels like it's self-explanatory, and Krita sounds like a nonsense word. Like, people don't have as big a problem with that, but the GIMP, everyone's like, wait, what are we talking about here? I don't know if I want to be associated with that.
No, man, I cannot open it with GIMP. I only have the GNU image manipulation program.
in a professional circle, or professional capacity, I suppose, at least, the GIMP's name probably works against it for sure. It's you have to explain its presence, and that's not a good foot to get off on when you're introducing someone to a toolkit that will rule
it's
their
true.
Life.
Alright, so to close off the show and to come back to Hand of Fate, each of you guys, assuming that you are going to go back and play a little bit more of the game, what are you looking forward to when you go back to play? Like, what is the thing that is drawing you back?
I am really looking forward to seeing how each of the levels expands in the more advanced rounds, the different options that become available, and the exploration of each round as it goes on, and what that will open up. How about you, Colin?
I'm actually really looking forward to all those crazy upgrades which you can get for your, well, armor, whatnot, weapon, whatnot. This is something, it's something that I really like. And obviously, if I'm able to catch maybe a glimpse of the story and see the end of it, that is one of the things. Well, in general, I like to be a completionist, but sometimes you just can't get rid of a game.
I'm kind of looking forward to checking out some of this new DLC content. I haven't seen any of the winter update stuff, or the winter hunt, I think it was called. And so I'm kind of looking to see what kind of story threads they weave in with that, because I think that stuff's really interesting. The ending is something that everybody likes to have a comment on, so it would be fun to like later come back once you guys have finished it and maybe do a spoilery type discussion of reflective discussion of the game.
That would be fun. I would like to do that. I'm probably about a third of the way through it, I think, now. A quarter to a third, something along those lines. So I'm sure I'll probably be at the end of it in a couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah. What if maybe it doesn't have an ending? It will be spoiler-free.
It does have an ending. Unless you're playing Endless Mode. If you're playing Endless Mode, then yeah.
Oh, wait, there's a story mode? God damn it!
Guys, it has been another fun episode. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, guys. It has been a wonderful discussion. So I guess we'll reconvene in 2 weeks.
Absolutely.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thanks to everyone who's listening.
And yes, yeah. and thanks to those people, too. That's probably a good thing to mention.
Thanks to everyone who's given the feedback on the first episode. It's been good to see the positive response there as well.
Yes, to go with the with the YouTube trends, like, comment, and subscribe, or whatnot.